the World Warrior Low Key.
Hey, it's Rotor Animal. This is Christopher Daniels.
Hi, gang. This is Mean Gene Okerlund from the WWE.
Hey, yo. Say hello to the bad guy, Scott Hall.
Big Daddy Cool Diesel / Kevin Nash.
Hey, this is Olympic gold medalist Kurt Angle from TNA.
Hi, this is Booker T, the 5-time WCW champion, and you're listening to SNN Radio Network.
Standing ovation here. Let's go to our ring announcer.
Welcome to the show that brings you all things nostalgia in the world of professional wrestling. It is now time to go Beyond the Bell.
Is in session. Welcome back, hardcore students. Professor Sean Beckerman returns to bring you ECW 101, the history of Extreme Championship Wrestling. Let's open up our textbooks to the chapter of 1998 as ECW was in a state of flux, coming off of a very big year, arguably the biggest year of the promotion. As the wrestling wars entered 1998, we came to the realization that these wannabe, extreme, pseudo-hardcore, lame-ass Monday Night Wrestling programs were spending too much time copying ECW. This was a quote from Paul Heyman on a February 1998 edition of ECW's Hardcore Wrestling syndicated program. In September of 97, ECW's world was thrown for a loop when Paul Heyman discovered that founder Todd Gordon had been acting as a WCW-sponsored mole by working from within to organize a mass exodus of ECW wrestlers into WCW. We didn't discuss this in our previous edition of ECW 101 because I wanted to tie it more so into the 98 chapter, as it really played an impact this year in ECW history, as all the work from Gordon working with WCW really took its toll now leading into 1998. Gordon had been the company's financial backer dating back to its inception, but he had sold it outright to Heyman sometime in 94 or 95. Apparently frustrated by the unglamorous figurehead commissioner role and Philadelphia event promoter roles, Gordon had contacted WCW booker Terry Taylor regarding leading the NWO type invasion of WCW. Taylor received word back that WCW would reward Gordon with a lucrative job. He could swing, you know, if really he could swing such a coup, for lack of a better phrase. Luckily for ECW, Heyman got wind of the scheme before Gordon could do much damage. The only wrestler to jump ship during this tumultuous period was the aforementioned Saturn. the bizarre Perry Saturn, and Heyman promptly fired Gordon upon learning of the plot. Still, the emotional blow of the bizarre turn of events left the company reeling and added to its underwriting sense of vulnerability, which really showed in 1998. Surprisingly, Heyman and Gordon did not end up on particularly hostile footing with one another, shockingly, right? And in an effort to make the split as amicable as possible, Joey Styles simply announced on TV that Gordon had resigned from ECW to concentrate on business and family matters. Very respectful from the Heyman ECW front. Without Gordon for the first time, the company marched on towards its third pay-per-view, the November 17th November to Remember. To set up the card, Rob Van Dam and Sabu continued to lead the heel charge, the full-blooded Italians, Tracy Smothers and Little Guido, and got a reign as transitional tag team champions, and Bam Bam Bigelow wrestled the ECW heavyweight title from Shane Douglas, Triple Threat members going at it. The event itself occurred before a then company record crowd of 4,300 fans in Monica, Pennsylvania. The storyline highlights of the show saw Al Snow debut his head gimmick in a backstage vignette, and Stevie Richards make a surprise return by interfering to help Rob Van Dam defeat Tommy Dreamer in a WWF versus ECW Coward Waves the Flag match. In the main event, Douglas vanquished Bigelow to reclaim his strap and send the crowd home happy. The show was met with mixed reviews, and as ECW entered 1998, it found itself struggling to adjust to the transformed state of wrestling during this time in the industry. Very, very, very transitional, transforming time with the Monday Night Wars, with talent shifting from promotion to promotion. So much was going on. It settled in as a moderately profitable entity on pay-per-view. House show revenue was at an all-time high, and its fan base was larger than ever. But the promotion was undeniably fraught with growing pains related to its wavering identity and lack of roster depth, which really it was seen this year in 98. WCW had long since stolen ECW's world-class workers, Benoit, Malenko, Guerrero, Jericho, Mysterio, Psicosis, Juventud Guerrera, thereby really depriving the company of one marketing niche. Even more damaging, Vince McMahon had lifted its other, more definitive selling point, attitude. The WWF's product adopted the racy, irreverent approach that had exclusively characterized ECW for the previous 4 years. And Vince had the wrestlers, the production values, and the national exposure to remain fresh and innovative to the vast majority of the Monday Night Wars-bred wrestling fan base. The WWF may have entirely pilfered ECW's image, but perception is reality in the wrestling business. And by comparison, Team Heyman began to look like a pandering minor league imitation rather than the cult revolution that had changed the face of wrestling.
I brought in Public Enemy to the WWF, and I didn't know that they had turned down a contractual offer by Bruce Pritchard and somebody else a couple of years before that when they came to WCW. They come up there and somebody buzzed Ron Simmons and Bradshaw and said, beat them up to see how they react. And I told Public Enemy, I said, this is coming. You know, don't say anything. And if you don't think that I felt horrible sending two people that I tried to offer an opportunity to, in, to the, you know, as a representative of the WWF, and then to tell them to take this beating to show that they are part of the team, to only get fired a week later, I'm ashamed of myself, and I'm ashamed at that time of the business that I was in, because those guys, I've been told by Vince McMahon 100 times, I don't offer guarantees, I offer opportunity. Everybody has an opportunity to excel here. Public Enemy didn't have a chance to excel. They were humiliated and fired.
Just one phone call, and out of one phone call, this urban myth was born that there was a mole in the company, and everybody's going to raid the company and bring the company down. As Paul and I got to talk more and more about it, we started realizing, wow, the boys, when the boys bite, you know the fans are going to bite.
People were like, oh, there's a mole in the locker room, but I never heard that talk.
Todd Gordon calls and has this big plan. He calls up and he goes, it was an invasion angle like the NWO that had started to wind down. And he goes, I can bring you this number of ECW talent and we can do an invasion. And, you know, and these guys were all working for ECW at the time. And I said, you clear that with Paul E and we'll talk. I said, if I hear Paul E tell me and go down the list of everybody you have, then we'll talk. And he goes, I can't do that. This is a deal. Well, we're going to cut, you know, we're going to take this group of people and come down there. And I said, we're going to be upfront about it and we're not going
to
do it.
Well, there's one performer go up to Paul and say, you know, I was part of that group supposed to be jumping WCW and they offered me $300,000 a year. Well, Paul knew there was no group jumping, so this guy's making a fool out of himself.
Todd and Paulie were partners at that point. I don't think the mole thing never could have really materialized.
But yet the legend of this mole story grew and grew and grew, and we just sat back and we just laughed.
The only time I was really bothered by somebody jumping from ECW was the time Stevie left ECW for WCW because there had been no notice of it.
Because I really didn't want to leave, but I also knew that influentially, we were no longer going to be an influence on the business like we were. I mean, and we weren't again.
The whole "you sold out" thing chanted by fans. Yeah, well, they did, you know, fine. So you're supposed to work for the most money you can get.
Bischoff and Vince would every once in a while try pulling a talent raid. Paulie had no choice but to lock guys in under a contract with some decent money. But, you know, the money wasn't there that we needed.
Maybe at one point, technically, we're all being overpaid because you got guys. I was making like $175,000 a year. I know Van Damme was making that, Sabu was making that, Shane was making that, Raven was making that. You know what I mean? So we were making just, you know, there was four or five guys that were making close to $1 million.
I've been pointed out as a lot of times that I was the one that took talent away from ECW, and that's not the case. I never took anybody or even presented anybody to WCW or Eric Bischoff that didn't call first.
Another obstacle, understandably, confronting Heyman was his conspicuously shallow talent roster, where it once seemed that ECW had been a safe haven for all of the wrestlers the WWF and WCW were too ignorant to want. Now it seemed that ECW consisted predominantly of wrestlers who were there only because they couldn't obtain or maintain a job in the Big Two. For instance, Justin Credible was a great talent, but 2 years removed from his WWF role as a jockstrap mask jobber, Aldo Montoya, his lack of national credibility, pun intended maybe, as a top heel, epitomized ECW's roster identity crisis. Chris Candido's reputation had also suffered gravely from his WWF burial as Body Donna Skip, even if he clearly still had major league talent. Stevie Richards' WCW run had curbed his marketability, and cumulative neck problems sadly forced him out of the company within weeks of his return. Even Bam Bam Bigelow, once the biggest surefire future star in the industry, seemed like a WWF castoff, with the albatross of his WrestleMania 11 loss to Lawrence Taylor following him everywhere. Even several of the mainstay wrestlers also struggled with a variety of perception and performance problems. Shane Douglas remained a terrific interview, excellent, but he was deteriorating physically, and the more ECW-tinged quality of the Big Two increased, the more hollow his and Joey Styles' criticism of the rival promotions became. Tommy Dreamer and the Sandman were the unquestioned faces of the company, but they were no longer the hot commodities they were a few years earlier, partially due to mounting injuries. Mikey Whipwreck had blossomed into a good worker, and he had been the beneficiary of some of Heyman's most inventive booking. By 98, with the lovable loser gimmick having run its course, really, the bloom had fallen from his burnt-out rose. Weapon-wielding brawlers like New Jack, Axel Rotten, Balls Mahoney were all good role-players, but the advent of violent brawling in the Big Two had mitigated the really the modernization of the style. It changed it to where it wasn't innovative, but it was now seen as replicative and duplicative of what the Big Two were doing now. It took that isolated identity away from ECW. Rob Van Dam and Sabu were spectacular. They were major league wrestlers, but they were not delivering the all-around great matches on the same plateau as Rey Mysterio and Shawn Michaels, just to name a few. And the buxom women, who had once been such an integral part of ECW's uniquely risque identity, lost much of their luster with the WWF's marketing of Sable, you know, Sunny, and other TNA-based acts. The expanded schedule was exacting an enormous physical toll on the entire company. Their style really fit the prototypical, you could say, indie type of schedule, where, you know, once or twice a week, you know, a couple big shows, but that style does not fit the Big Two type of schedule where you're having multiple shows a week. ECW wrestlers had always performed, you know, perilous stunts and exerted a superior level of effort to that of other promotions wrestlers. And once they began performing on, you know, 3-5 shows per week rather than two, like I said, their injury rate skyrocketed. Nearly every member of the roster was combating some sort of physical ailment. And ECW veterans like Dreamer, Sandman, Sabu, Whipwreck were the chief casualties of this. Dreamer, especially, in trying to live up to his Innovator of Violence handle, he had spent the previous several years bumping through stacks of tables from atop balconies and cages. His performance was starting to reflect the ravaging, the beating on his body. There were, of course, several acts who reaped the bountiful benefits of the old Heyman magic. Even with ECW at a creative ebb, you could say, Al Snow's new head gimmick was a runaway success. The deranged Snow claimed to hear voices from a mannequin head, which he literally used to spout sexual double entendres. And the crowd soon adopted the head, 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 that chant as its most popular, quote, chant moniker in the organization. ECW often capitalized on the craze by handing out miniature mannequins to the crowd prior to Snow's ring entrances, so that the audience transformed into a wave of white-headed shaking, or we should say white head shaking. Those the look, the lights going down, the glow in the dark, seeing all those heads move, the Prodigy song, Breathe, it fits so well and innovative. It rejuvenated, it literally saved Al Snow's career.
Taz, you know, was one of the most over people I've ever seen. You know, he was, those people, you know, really believed he was the toughest guy in the world.
You know, when you first meet Taz, he's not intimidating looking from a size standpoint, but his style of wrestling and the explosiveness in which the way he would throw his suplexes was so believable.
But Paulie and Taz convinced the world that he was the toughest motherfucker on the planet.
He's cool, good wrestler.
Taz ain't shit. Taz is a character. He got everybody food. He's tough. Taz is a fucking cartoon character. He's a t-shirt.
Very disciplined, very respectful, and I have a tons of respect for Taz.
Taz lived his character a little bit too much, believed his own character a little bit too much.
First time I ever met Taz, he didn't really like me at all. We had a few words about my moneymaker. I gave it to me and Mikey Whipwreck were tag teaming one night in Staten Island, New York at the Sports Fest against his cousin Chris Chetty, who was brand new straight out of the camp, and he had a tag team partner. We wrestled, I gave him the move, and the crowd just went ballistic shit because it was the first time they had ever seen it. Taz was like pissed off, mad, thought that I could have hurt Chris, which, you know, is a possibility, but I've, you know, honestly, I've done that move for 15 years and I've never hurt anybody ever with it. But, I mean, it looks devastating. He called it a tiger bomb. He said it was a fucked up tiger bomb. And I said, no, it's a pile driver. And he said, no, it's a fucking tiger bomb. I said, no, it's a fucking pile driver. He said, did you tell him you was going to do it? I was like, yes, I told him I was going to do it. And he called him over there just to make sure I told him. And then he really didn't have too much to say after that. But, I mean, I stood my ground, and he stood his ground. And luckily there was no, you know, hands being thrown. I got reprimanded by Paul. Of course, I had every right to be, because, you know, Taz was the elder of the group, and apologized, was water under the bridge, and we got along ever since.
Me and Taz never, we didn't get along either in ECW. Taz hated the laugh. Like, Taz was just not a manic depressive, he was just a depressive. Like, he was always depressed, always miserable, and I would, like, just make him laugh, and it would drive him insane. He hated laughing. And so I would tell these just horrible jokes, and he would start laughing, and he'd want to kill me for making him laugh. It was really bizarre.
And then when he got married, he finally loosened up a little.
Taz's rise continued in earnest, as his interviews were par excellence in their intensity, and he successfully created a personal championship title belt. The F the World title that only enhanced his appeal. FTW title.
I have a great match at the ECW Arena, right? Me and John Cronus, one half of the best tag team in the world, the Eliminators. We went toe to toe. You know, I traveled with this guy, I've trained with him, I've broken bread with him, and I choked him out. But you see, that wasn't enough. Now, the people left the building that night not talking about, hey, what a great match Taz and Cronus had. Oh, hey, those ECW wrestlers, man, they busted their ass tonight. No, they didn't say that. See, what they said was, Jerry Lawler and Jim Cornette invaded the ECW. And Sabu and Van Damme, they're with them. Yeah. Yeah. Who cares? I'm sick of this. Who gives a f*** about it? I'm sick of it messing up me and my life. Instead of training from Monday morning to Monday afternoon to Monday evening, I'm sitting home watching TV that WWF. Which one of my coworkers is going to jump a railing tonight? Which one of my coworkers is going to start a feud tonight? Or better yet, who's going to do color commentating tonight? Who's going to do it tonight?
What the hell are you doing?
Yeah, that's the question I have, Paul. Now, you want to be a TV star? Well, guess what, brother? I put you on TV. Make up your mind. I'll tell you what, Vince. Later on in this show, I got a message for you, directed from me to you. Not as Mr. Hardcore, Mr. ECW, or the World TV Champ. From me to you, man to p***. And while you sit in your big, fat, lavish office with all your jabronis kissing your fat ass, telling you, hey, Vince, that Taz, he's a real asshole. Don't listen to him. He's a jerk. Yeah, I'm a jerk. I'm the biggest asshole in this industry. Those same jabronis used to come to Coney Island when I was 9 years old, and I'd mug them and their fat wives and fat kids and stretch them at nine. Ex-Sabu. Ask him. I choked him out not once but twice. Ask him, Vince. Ask Van Damme. Ask him what I am. I'm the World TV Champ. Beat me if you can. Survive if I let you.
Rob Van Dam continued to emerge as a legitimate superstar, winning the TV title from Bam Bam Bigelow in April of 98 in an awesome match, perhaps the company's best of the year. Meanwhile, the Dudleys were also on their way to the top, and Balls Mahoney found a popular, albeit, you know, masochistic and short-lived niche as the guy who gets powerbombed through flaming tables. Unfortunately, the company's first two pay-per-views of 98 strongly reflected the hot-cold dichotomy that marked ECW at the time. The March 1st, 1998 Living Dangerously pay-per-view in Asbury Park, New Jersey did not want for spectacular moments in a tag titles match. New Jack and Spike dove from atop a balcony onto Bubba and Devon, and Bam Bam Bigelow pinned Taz to win the TV title after both have fallen through the ring. That was innovative in itself. However, beyond those memorable stunts, It was an average show that once again failed to differentiate ECW from its two bigger budgeted competitors.
Wasn't a big surprise. Living Dangerously, Asbury Park, New Jersey, Bam Bam Bigelow's hometown. That is exactly why they call me the Beast from the East. And that is why they call me now the Taz Killer. You gotta understand something. I am the biggest, and I am the baddest, and I am the toughest that ever stepped into the squared circle, especially here in ECW. You know, when I was in juvie, and I'd watch the wrestling every Saturday, I'd get 1 hour of free time just to look up at the TV. And I used to see these old-timers holding their belt. And they used to say, well, if you want this belt, you gotta beat me, brother. Well, it's a whole new ballgame. It's a whole new game. Because let me tell you something. If you want this belt, you gotta beat me.
And a living head.
Hey, next week on television, next week on ECW TV, it's gonna be all Sabu. It's not gonna be Spud. It's not gonna be New Jack falling off with poverty, barely hitting the table. Because he is the king of table. He is the king of his team. He's Sabu. He's so smooth now. There's nobody to line him up, New Jack. There's nobody gonna compare to Sabu. 150 tables. Next week, line him up, baby. Because we are the king. Get off Bundle Sabu, baby. You got it. You got it, baby. It's so.
You're not giving up, Bob. Like he's saying, there's nobody better than Mr. Monday Night Rob Van Dam and his partner Sabu. You know, call me a pro wrestler, call me a movie star, call me a world weightlifting record holder, call me a babysitter. No offense, Sabu. Hey, carrying my partner is a lot of hard work. Not that it doesn't pay off. I mean, after all, I don't mind a little hard work. Hey, Sabu, check this out. I'm Rob Van Dam, the one man that Bam Bam Bigelow so far has not figured out how to be. Go figure. How about it for Rob Van Dam, Sabu? Exactly. Here's my point. Rob Van Dam and Sabu,
right here, Sabu,
the whole show right here. Why the hell go anywhere else?
Oh, fine. Now, I'm not funny. Was it my idea to put Mr. Wright in a helicopter? What's next? We're going to put him in a submarine at WrestlePalooza?
Titan Stooge, McMahon, Suck Boy, Sellout, No Good, and Rich Mama's Boy.
Jerome Young. On the streets, it's New Jack. Not a studio gangster. Not a cartoon character. But an original gangster. An original bop gangster.
The head. The big mystery partner at Living Dangerously. Woohoo!
Living Dangerously. Being embarrassed on the largest pay-per-view in this company's history.
You think it bothers me? You're dead wrong. It doesn't bother me. I don't care.
Al Snow, I know what you're doing. Yes. Oh, I know what you're doing. Trying to play head games with the franchise. Okay, Al Snow, okay.
I had to console Shane Douglas like only the head cheerleader knows how. And as we're laying in bed, and he's screaming Francine, and I'm screaming back Shane.
You think it bothers me? I pull up the highway to get a bottle of water riding down the highway, and I see fans of yours waving the stinking styrofoam head at the rest stop. You think it bothers me when I walk into the arenas and all those thousands of fans are waving that styrofoam head from the front of the arena to the back? It doesn't bother me. It doesn't.
He screams, head, head, and I scream,
May 3rd, WrestlePalooza. That's my belt. It's my company. And you, Al Snow, are just another pretender to the throne. Just another Johnny come lately who's earned the title shot against the franchise. And like the rest, Al Snow, like the rest, we'll find out what the Bella de Belli means. And why they call me a French.
The May 3rd WrestlePalooza pay-per-view in Marietta, Georgia, met with similar critical apathy. Rob Van Dam competed against Sabu in a disappointing 30-minute time limit draw between temporarily divided tag team partners, while Shane Douglas retained the ECW championship against the WWF-bound Al Snow. Distressingly enough, never had the company's staleness and injury problems been more evident. Even when Heyman makes a star in Al Snow, revitalizing his career, he was technically on loan from the WWF, so once they saw a potential gimmick to transition very well into the attitude that the WWF had with the head gimmick, you take away a potential future ECW champion and star that could have taken the company for another year or two to headline pay-per-views. So that played a big part as well in the mystique and aura, the diminished aura of ECW.
Al Snow, there are critics of mine that say that what I'm going to get tonight at WrestlePalooza, I deserve. Fractured palate, broken arm necessitating surgery, a fractured cheekbone, infected sinuses. Every single doctor I've seen, five specialists have told me and given me their advice to not step in the ring tonight. You're right, Al Snow. About 15 or 16 years ago, two young boys entered a sport, hoping one day to be the world heavyweight champion. One of us has fulfilled that dream, and the other one of us has a burning desire to fulfill that dream. Tonight, Al Snow, I'm not going to promise any victories. I will tell you this, Al Snow. Destiny may be on your side. Fate certainly is. But there is one thing against you, Al Snow. The fact that Shane Douglas is a franchise. And he proves it time and again. And when I walk down that aisle tonight, Al Snow, you may kick me from pillar to post. You can go after my arm. I don't expect you to go easy on me, Al Snow. But I'll tell you this, goddammit. If you are going to take this from me, then you're going to have to kill me for it. Because my destiny and this company's destiny lie together. So now, Al Snow, let's go to the ring and let's find out who's the better man. Because win or lose, after I walk down the aisle, I may not be the world's heavyweight champion, but I will forever, in this history, this sport will know me as a fighting champion and as a franchise.
Oh, man. Since 1905, wrestling fans around the world have recognized the NWA World Heavyweight title as the World Championship. But that era came to an end in August 1994 when the franchise Shane Douglas threw the NWA World title belt down in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and ushered in the era of the new World Heavyweight Championship, the ECW World title. But Shane Douglas's title reign has not been without controversy. Professional wrestling's most outspoken world heavyweight champion started to protect his title reign at Heatwave 96 when Francine double-crossed the pit bulls. And Shane Douglas broke the neck of Pitbull 1 Gary Wolf. Shane Douglas added Francine to his arsenal, and Francine took the title of the head cheerleader. October 5th, 1996, Gary Wolf returns to wrestling, but Shane Douglas shocks the world and takes sports to a whole new extreme. Shane and Francine have taunted their opponents since day one. But he's not without backing, because Shane Douglas's every move is guarded by Chris Candido and Bam Bam Bigelow. And it is the passion with which Francine and the Triple Threat protect Shane Douglas's title reign that separates just another world heavyweight champion, just another belt holder from a championship era. But even a champion as passionate as the franchise must realize that his day in the sun must one day come to an end. And for Shane Douglas, that day was Sunday night, March 1st, Asbury Park, New Jersey. The Living Dangerously pay-per-view. Al Snow scores a pinfall victory in a tag team match over the franchise Shane Douglas. The thought that his title era may be coming to an end sent the franchise into a frenzy. And it's that frenzy that has turned Extreme Championship Wrestling upside down. Al Snow tonight tries to get inside the head of the franchise Shane Douglas. Is this the end of the championship era of the franchise? Al Snow goes for the World Heavyweight title, and we may be headed into a new championship era tonight.
May 22nd, 1982. That's when all this began, Shane. All of this a long time ago. Nearly 16 years. It's almost my entire adult life I have dedicated to this moment, to this night. Working to get to this time, to my time, my day in the sun. For years, I've been held back. For years, I've been frustrated. For years, I've had fate play against me. I've left the territory when I should have stayed. I've been hired by a guy who got fired. Where you, on the other hand, with your good looks, you were Mr. Marketable. And hey, I'm not begrudging you. You're a talented guy. You got what you got. But I think I was better. And I didn't get those breaks. 16 years, Shane. Up and down the highways, back and forth across this country for next to nothing and nothing, for no other reason than for tonight. For tonight, I have lived for tonight. I have sacrificed for tonight. I have given up everything for tonight. And tonight is my night, Shane, not yours. Whether you think this promotion is yours or not, doesn't matter. Because tonight, you can't change anything. Oh, I know what everybody's saying. I know what they're going to say when, you know, if I win, which I will win, Shane. They're saying, oh, Al only beat him because he had a broken arm, because he had a fractured cheekbone, broken palate. Shane, I beat you the last pay-per-view right in the middle of the ring. 1, 2, 3. Instead of me hearing that sound next to my ear, you got to hear it. And tonight, Shane, you're going to hear it again. Because I really don't care. I really don't give a damn if your arm's broken, if your face is busted, if your leg's crippled. I really don't care how I beat you. I don't care anymore. All I care about is the fact that tonight is my night, and tonight I'm going to win for a change. Tonight the breaks are going to go my way. Tonight the fates are going to be on my side instead of against me. And you know why else I think I'm going to win? I think. I know I'm going to win. I'll tell you, Shane. Because the head told me so.
Ups and downs, bumps and bruises. Not just for the talent, but for ECW in general. This would lead to finally ECW going on national television. You would think this would be a huge event in the company's history. It was, but there was a rocky road leading to TNN. Paul Heyman surely realized he needed to rebuild several aspects of his company, and in August of 98, he gave ECW fans cause for stout optimism, you could say, ECW scored with its biggest aesthetic success since Barely Legal when it presented Heatwave 98 in Dayton, Ohio on August 21st. In fact, for great in-ring wrestling, it was the best pay-per-view any wrestling company produced all year. Most spectacularly, new arrivals Mike Awesome and Masato Tanaka had a terrific four-star match, imported straight from Japanese fringe group FMW. A Taz vs. Bam Bam Bigelow bout was almost as good, while Chris Candido vs. Lance Storm and Justin Credible vs. Jerry Lynn were strong, pure wrestling exhibitions. Sabu and RVD vs. the former Hakushi, Jinsei Shinsaki, and Hayabusa provided 21 minutes of high-flying fun. It seemed that ECW was going back to their roots of pure in-ring talent. Buy rates continued to hover in an immutable 0.2 to 0.25 range, better than what TNA was doing, but ECW now had virtually 100% clearance in the pay-per-view universe, so its profit margin from the events had increased substantially over the 97 shows. That would seem to be a good thing for ECW, wouldn't you think? The company had also successfully expanded into Michigan, Georgia, Illinois, Ohio, Louisiana, and several other markets outside of its regional house show base. And the cards generally drew in the line of 1,500 to 4,000 fans in that range, a substantial increase over the 500 to 1,500 it drew in 95-96. Moreover, although per cap merchandise sales were likely down from 94 to 96 and its peak of hardcore fever, a significantly larger fan base meant significantly greater sales of ECW paraphernalia, and its relative commerce of company-branded items still more than held its own at this point. As a matter of fact, the crowd of 3,400 at WrestlePalooza 98 in Marietta, like we mentioned, bought $18.97 per head worth of merchandise, an all-time pay-per-view record for any U.S. company. For me, I like the different style of ECW shirts. When I went to the Asbury Park pay-per-view, I picked up the white Rob Van Dam shirt because all t-shirts were black. See, like, all wrestling t-shirts were all black. I like Taz having the orange shirts. Just a little different style, a little different marketing, a different look than the big two.
For those who feel that being on top of the ECW tag team scene is as good as it gets in the wrestling business because of our long-reigning tag team champions, like the Public Enemy, defeated by the Dudley Boys. The Gangsters, New Jack and Mustafa, defeated by the Dudley Boys. The Eliminator, Saturn and Cronus, defeated by the Dudley Boys. Sabu and Rob Van Dam, also defeated by the Dudley Boys. Now they are seven-time World Tag Team Champions, and we fear they will disgrace our World Tag Team title belts by going on to Monday Night Raw and handing them over to the McMahon family. Standing by now with comments, the seven-time World Tag Team Champions, Bubba Ray and Devon, the Dudley Boys.
In a promotion filled with misfits, in a promotion full of outcasts, you're looking at three brothers from Dudleyville, the biggest misfits and the biggest outcasts this world has ever seen. Goofy guys that wear glasses with tape and tie-dyed shirts. Goofy guys who did it their way. Yeah, we gave our notice. Everybody knows that the Dudley Boys are on their way out. The question is, are we going to do the right thing by ECW and the right thing for the wrestling business? We're going to do what we want to do. The Public Enemy passed the torch to the Gangsters. The Gangsters passed the torch to the Eliminators. The Eliminators passed the torch to Sabu and Van Dam. Me and Devon took the torch from everybody. Are we gonna do the right thing? No, we're not. We're doing what we wanna do. We're not doing the job. I'm not putting anybody over. He ain't putting anybody over. We're the greatest tag team that ever stepped foot in an ECW ring, and we plan to keep it that way. And now we're gonna do something we should have did a hell of a long time ago. We're taking these belts and we're getting on I-95 and we're heading north to the true city of hardcore wrestling, Stamford, Connecticut. I'm walking in that front door with my brothers by my side and these World Tag Team titles that belong to us. We're going to step in that elevator and press the number 4. And it's going to take us straight to the top, to the office of the man that means everything in professional wrestling today. To the office of the man that's going to make the Dudley Boys millionaires. And let us do whatever we please. To the office of Vince McMahon, our hero and our savior. We're going to take these belts. We're going to lay them down at his feet and climb on to his altar and give him our souls. You people don't deserve to see the Dudley Boys ever again. Me and Devon take great pleasure in taking the greatest tag team that ever lived and bringing it to greener pastures.
We are the Dudley Boys. And if you ever want to see an ECW World Tag Team title again, all you have to do is tune in to WWF Monday Night Raw on Monday nights. Now get the hell out of here! It's over! Don't you think I'm playing with you, boy? Get the hell out of here! Get the hell out of here! Right there!
As always, there were hits and misses throughout the talent roster. The quintessential stud muffin, Joel Gertner, the loudmouth, punchy, sex-obsessed sidekick of the Dudleys, was definitely one of the former bunch. He had emerged with one of the most entertaining shticks in wrestling in 96, and his charges correspondingly emerged as the top team in the company, winning the tag titles from Sabu and Rob Van Dam on October 24th, 1998, in Cleveland, Ohio. The Dudleys were ECW Tag Team Champions.
Is it hot in here, or is it just me? Well, well, well. Dayton, Ohio. Amazing where people can live these days. It is I, the man your mother warned you about, the man that makes your panties moist, and the only man that matters, hotter than a heat wave and harder than Chinese algebra, the quintessential stud muffin myself, Joel. I always leave them sore, yet they keep coming back for more, Gertner. Also in the ring at this time, he is a referee with integrity and a referee with hair. The extreme official, Jeff Jones.
What a sellout.
Accompanying him to ringside, the trashiest prostitute to ever enter professional wrestling, our valet and love slave,
come on,
Beulah McGillis Slutty.
That damn doll is the only way Gertner's ever going to get laid in this lifetime.
And at my right, my colleague, you saw him suffer on ECW television, a torn ACL, a damaged patella tendon, a ruptured rectum.
I bet Joe caused that injury himself.
I mean a deviated septum and a kidney stone. Nonetheless, he stands before you as the quiet behind the riot and the innovator of silence, Side Guy Dudley.
Lance Storm developed one of the most refreshing acts in the business, exhibiting a unique charisma. Yes, Lance Storm and charisma goes together. That served him well, both in singles matches and his frequent tag team outings with Just Incredible, creating the Impact Players. And in case you forgot him, he made sure you knew he was from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Fellow Canadian Don Cyrus Callis, a.k.a. the Jackal of the Truth Commission in the WWF, brought the same skill mic work that he had made him, that really made him a WWF and Ontario-based independent standout. Spike Dudley continued to bump and batter his 130-pound body to the top of the card. Chastity and female bodybuilder Nicole Bass supplemented Just Incredible's ascending act. Tammy Lynn Sitch and Tammy Lynn Bitch, who accompanied Chris Candido and Lance Storm, respectively, now known as Dawn Marie, were welcome additions. Let's not forget Yoshihiro Tajiri and Super Crazy injected a dose of top rim work rate to the mid card. They were rebuilding their roster. In September, ECW sadly bid adieu to the Sandman, the venerable, at least within the confines of ECW, hardcore icon who became embroiled in a money dispute with Heyman and shortly thereafter signed a 3-year contract with WCW. He only collected the cool Time Warner paychecks for about a year before receiving his wrongful termination. But over the short term, many a fan pinned for his made-for-ECW exploits. Also, newcomer Mike Awesome had to undergo reconstructive knee surgery just weeks after his debut, which was red-hot facing Masato Tanaka. Although his Heatwave opponent, the aforementioned, stuck around and continued to get over by taking the stiffest chair shots in the business. In spite of the Sandman's departure, ECW had an opportunity to build on the momentum it created at Heatwave. This is when it presented its 7th pay-per-view, November to Remember, on November 1st in New Orleans, the home of WrestleMania 30. Unfortunately, the card was marred by creative misfirings and inconsistent ring work, and its only saving grace was a very good Lance Storm vs. Jerry Lynn match on the mid-card. Most of the card was poor to average, and in the principal example of the booking miscalculations, Jake the Snake Roberts made an embarrassing, tipsy surprise appearance and laid out just incredible. Who was the man Heyman was now grooming to be his top heel? Also, Sabu won a poorly executed number one contender's 6-man match, and Balls Mahoney and Masato Tanaka won the tag team titles from the Dudleys in a disappointing bout, to say the least. Coming off the disappointing show, ECW and its fans were left reeling from still more bad news when Bam Bam Bigelow defected to WCW. This is where he began a program with Goldberg. Bigelow had not been part of the core of ECW like Sandman, but he was a strong big man worker with big league credibility, very underrated, and he had played a fundamental role in several of ECW's best matches during late 97 and 98. In a promotion already in the throes of talent poverty, his departure was yet another in a seemingly limitless array of roster setbacks. As always, ECW managed to bounce back, and their goal was still to land themselves on national television.
I got something to say. You see, what you people don't know about, the triple threat don't want to admit it. Every one of those scumbag wrestlers don't want to admit it. And most of all, the ECW, a.k.a. Paul Heyman, won't admit that I am the World Heavyweight Champion. And it's simple. Hey, it's even simple from you people, for you people from Staten Island, you see. I single-handedly destroyed everybody's hero, Shane Douglas. I busted his skinny arm. I busted his face. That makes me the champ. And hey, everybody knows that there's no way a from Pittsburgh can beat up a man from Brooklyn. Hold up. So what I got right here, you see, I'm not the uncrowned champion because I am the World Heavyweight Champion, and this is the proof. You could call it the Brooklyn World Belt. You could call it the World Belt. You could call it anything you want. But enough with the chitter chatter. Shane Douglas. Shane Douglas. You piece of. Why don't you come out here, belt for belt, Brooklyn versus Pittsburgh, and bring it.
Some major events in 1998 that gave us the first Stairway to Hell match, with Sandman taking on Sabu. Japanese talent returned to the ECW arena throughout the year with Gran Hamada, Gran Nanawa, Onita, And of course, we mentioned Masato Tanaka. The pairing that gave ECW Match of the Year nominee 2 years running gave arena fans a match to behold on August 8th as Jerry Lynn took on RVD, Rob Van Dam. The first of many Tanaka awesome matches happened in August, like we mentioned previously, as they took the phrase stiff to a whole new level. Some of the other names seen in ECW and the arena during this time frame in 1998 included Danny Doring, Roadkill, Bobby Duncombe Jr., Doug Furness, Supernova, Mike Lozansky, Jack Victory, Ulf Herman, Big Sal Graziano, Rod Price, and the One Man Gang. As we close the books on 1998, we move ahead to ECW on national television as TNN lays a wait to the land of the extreme. What is left for ECW as they enter mainstream media on a national platform? Would things have to change? Would they lose more talent to the WWF and WCW? Could they bounce back and create new blood into the extreme promotion? 1999 was another pivotal year for the promotion, as a lot of changes were made, bumps and bruises, not just for the talent, but for Paul Heyman himself behind the scenes. And I cannot wait to break down the historic moments in ECW history in 1999.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey guys, JJ Sexay here. Are you looking for the latest news in both professional wrestling and mixed martial arts? Well, check out www.wrestling-online.com. Sign up for one of the longest-running newsletters in professional wrestling, over 16 years, and just like Wrestling News Live, it's absolutely free. Join over 27,000 other subscribers, wrestling-online.com.
You will learn to pronounce my name properly.
Wrestling-online.com.
Are you a fan of the SNS radio network? Want to keep up with what's going on with all the personalities and radio shows on the SNS network? Well, let me tell you how. You can check out the Facebook group over at www.facebook.com/groups/SNS Radio Network. On Twitter, follow us at SNS Radio Network. You can follow me, Mr. Money on the Mic, Jeff Jackson, at SNS_JJSexay1. These are just a few ways to keep up with all the happenings going on the SNS Radio Network.
For those of you craving more nostalgia, download all of the archive shows at ringannouncing.com as well as snsradionetwork.com. Smartphone users, find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio. Brand new shows are streamed live every Saturday night and archived the following Monday at snsradionetwork.com. Connect socially to Beyond the Bell on Twitter and tout at Sean Beckerman. Become a fan of Beyond the Bell on our Facebook fan page. Email the show directly at Beckerman@ringannouncing.com. 98 was memorable. We saw some stars leave, the Sandman and such, but we saw some new main event talent created and career saved. Speaking of career saved, we'll take you home with some old school music. One of my favorite themes from the land of the extreme was for Al Snow, the reinvented Al Snow, with his brand new head gimmick, with his mannequin head in tow, like I mentioned on a previous edition of the Behind the Mic portion of Beyond the Bell. I could not believe that I was being told from Al Snow, give me head, as his head was on the announce table that I was next to the, you know, up against the ring with. Couldn't believe I was gonna announce Al Snow for one, and then have him say to me, "Give me head." The character worked. The insane "Help me" written backwards on his forehead worked, and Al Snow was reborn in ECW. His theme song was "Breathe" by Prodigy. So I'll take it home with some Al Snow extreme music here on Beyond the Bell. Until next week, fans. when we rewind and relive all things retro, sometimes hardcore, sometimes extreme in wrestling. This is your professor, Sean Beckerman, signing off another class completed as we go through ECW 101. Until next week, stay hardcore, my friends.